Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2024. I'm one of your hosts, Phil Esco.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, a much less well-known podcaster. And they brought in a big star this week.
She's back. Karina Longworth is back to talk with us about Robert Altman's, I'm just going to say, masterpiece, at least filmmaking in terms of the industry itself, The Player. Thank you so much for coming back and talking with us, Karina.
Of course. I'm so always happy to talk about The Player, a movie that I have at least one third memorized.
So you have seen this many times, I'm assuming. Did you see this as a younger Karina? Was this a staple for you in terms of how you saw the industry?
I saw it at least three times in the movie theater. This was when, in 1992. I mean, this was when movies like this like could become what they used to call sleeper hits and just be playing, you know, at one or two theaters in Los Angeles once or twice a day for like 8 months. And so I, you know, saw it a few times in the theater, and then I bought like a remaindered copy on VHS at Blockbuster. And it was, you know, one of like maybe six VHS tapes that I just had kind of on rotation throughout high school.
Do you remember where you saw it, movie theater wise, by any chance? Just out of curiosity, having not lived here in 92?
Yeah, probably at City Walk.
Nice.
And then maybe at the Beverly Center as well. There used to be a Cineplex Odeon at the Beverly Center that was pretty cool.
That's amazing. I
gotta say, like, when I think The Player, I think Universal City Walk. Like, that feels like where I want to see this movie.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they should really bring back movies now more than ever to, you know, City Walk.
So, just because I need to pick your brain on this, having been here in 92 when this film comes out, seeing it in theaters, did you get a sense of how this film was being received? You know, what this town felt of it?
I mean, I was 11 and 12 years old, you know, so I mean, I talked about it with my friends in junior high.
Sure.
I didn't really know a lot of adults.
I totally get that.
I didn't know anybody in the film industry at that time.
Fair enough. I mean, Emily, you obviously had seen this film previously, or no?
Yeah, I didn't see it in theaters. I remember when it was the end of 92, I was just starting to get into the phase where all I did was read film criticism. And a lot of people were like, this was the best movie of the year. And I was like, what the fuck is The Player? Because it like did not play in South Dakota. To the best of my knowledge, and I tried to research this, it's very hard to find movie times from 1992 for Sioux Falls, South Dakota. But yeah, it looks like it didn't play there at all. I did do a little bit of digging, and it seems like this movie was quite well received within LA. You know, like the LA critics loved it. Obviously you can't say for sure what happened within the industry, but I think it was a bit of an Oscar disappointment, and I wager that was more because it came out in the spring than anything else. You know, it got buried by a bunch of late releases.
It was on 80 critics year end best lists. It was only second to Howard's End in 92. So like, this was a very well-received movie critically, which isn't a surprise.
Howard's End, another spring movie. What a time.
But it's one of those films that I watched my Criterion of it the other day, which has all sorts of really great special features and documentaries on the making of it. And it does feel like they kind of knew they were getting allowed to make a thing that was thumbing its nose at the industry. And I do think that, to your point, Emily, the Oscars don't tend to like that so much.
I think this movie is very satirical. I don't think it's satire is particularly, it's the kind of satire Hollywood can embrace, you know, it's like Simpson satire, like where it's like, we're making fun of the thing, we're biting the hand that feeds, but we're also like very much part of the hand that feeds. And like, that's why this is Altman's comeback. Like, he spends the 80s very much like fucking pissed off.
And like, sure.
Yeah. So like, but this is like, this is as, it's obviously not super mainstream, but it does feel like it's playing within the rules of what sort of satire Hollywood will allow about itself. Although like, maybe I'm watching this from a 2024 perspective, and the things this movie is satirizing, I'm just like, God, if I could trick Peter Gallagher into making a gritty death penalty drama, I would.
I do think part of it's the ending too, but yes, sorry. Go ahead, Kurt.
Oh, I was just going to say that I do see it in the trajectory of a certain type of movie that I really like, of like Hollywood movies about Hollywood. You know, you could count The Bad and the Beautiful, you know, the first couple of A Star is Borns, which are these movies where Hollywood is saying to the audience, we're going to pull back the curtain and show you how fucked up everything is, but in a way that completely reifies your desire for Hollywood and, like, you know, star worship and all of that. And so I think this movie has a certain bite to it. But it also is like, isn't it great that Robert Altman got 75 people to make cameos?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I didn't see this in the theater, but I did see it shortly thereafter. And I'd be lying if I said that this didn't sort of define Hollywood for a young me. I mean, at 12 or 13 years old, this was like, oh, so this is what Hollywood is like, right? Like, this is, it had that feeling of, like you said, getting to see behind the curtain and getting to see sort of behind the velvet rope of sort of how Hollywood really works. And even watching it the other day, I still feel like it's kind of defined my worldview of this industry, which is that, I think to your point, Emily, it's biting and satirical, but playful and accessible at the same time, and isn't sort of too harsh, if that makes sense. Like, Altman's even talked about how, like, when all the accolades came in, he was just like, we were too easy on them. Like, we didn't go hard enough, which I think there's something to that.
Even though
it centers a murderer.
Yeah. Exactly. And he gets away with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't like really tell you who the actual stalker is. Like, you can figure it out if you like really pay attention, but like, it does not care to tell you who it just is. Like, this guy killed somebody and now he's going to, like, you know, try and kill other people's careers, and we're going to love it.
Yeah. And it's fine. I mean, I do think that, you know, we did Bob Roberts earlier in the run of our sort of 92 miniseries and or series, if you will. And, you know, Tim Robbins, who at this point is still sort of, you know, becoming a lead actor. I mean, Bob Roberts, obviously, he's the lead in his own film, and he's great in Bull Durham. And like, but this is sort of the first like hanging a movie on him. He's so good in this movie. I mean, Yes, Emily?
Is it hanging, like, obviously he's the star, and yeah, like, the movie doesn't work if he's not at the center, but like, you're also not really marketing it on the name Tim Robbins, you know?
For sure. Yeah, I don't mean to suggest that, like, they're trying to make him into a star necessarily.
I mean, one person known for star-making films, Robert Altman. Like, that's all he did.
I mean, I do feel like, I'm just kind of looking at his filmography, and it is interesting. I mean, obviously he's in stuff. He's in Top Gun and Howard Duck and Bull Durham and what have you. But, you know, Jacob's Ladder, which is a movie that kind of bombed notoriously. He's the lead in that. And then, I mean, truthfully, 94, God bless him, IQ, Pret-a-Porte, Shawshank Redemption, Hudsucker Proxy. That's, I mean,
are you guys doing 94 next?
I mean, we should, but it is really sort of interesting. And then in 95, he writes and directs Dead Man Walking, which is sort of his cashing in all of the cachet that he has in that moment. But, you know, Shawshank notoriously tanks in theaters, obviously a beloved film now, but doesn't do particularly well. Hudsucker Proxy is, you know, an enormous failure, even though it's one of my favorite Coen Brothers films. He's got a fascinating career. I don't know. He's an interesting star. What are your thoughts on him, Karina?
Well, you've neglected to mention one of my favorites, which is Tapeheads.
Sure, of course. Everyone's favorite. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it just has like somebody, you know, who was young and alive at this time. I mean, the first... Tapeheads was a big thing that was on cable all the time. And so I think that movie was a lot bigger of a deal than it was. But sure. I mean, by the time I saw The Player, I knew Tim Robbins from Bull Durham. And, you know, I can't say that I think that he ever like was better in a movie than he is in The Player. I do feel a little bit like I don't know what he's been up to lately. I remember seeing him at the Oscars and everybody, or I wasn't at the Oscars this year. I was watching it at home and everybody in the room where I was watching it was like, huh, Tim Robbins. Like,
oh,
is he castable? Yeah.
Oh,
Emily's
he's on the Apple TV Plus original Silo, on which he's very good. That's he's right. like Forgot kind of, that. He's kind of like playing the Tim Robbins role, but what if bad? And it's like, but like because he's playing it as Tim Robbins, you're always like, I know this guy's bad because I know the structure of this kind of story, but he's Tim Robbins. Come on. He can't be that bad.
He has been doing a fair amount of TV. He was in the Alan Ball Here and Now show, which was not very good. And then he was in Castle Rock.
Disastrous.
That he was in. Yeah, it's probably better that you don't. And it was a very strange, not good show.
Remember back when HBO would give everything a second season, but then Tim Robbins did two shows for them. They did not give
the Brink and Here and Now. They're just like, yeah, we're good with just one season.
Sorry, Tim.
But he is in Silo. I'm similar to you, Karina, waiting for him to sort of have a movie kind of comeback. I mean, obviously he wins his Oscar for Mystic River, but that was, again, that's 2003. That's a long time ago.
I think that's one of his worst roles too.
Yeah, and I don't particularly like
him. He's I mean, this is a 2019 film, and 2019 is 5 years ago, which feels fucking wrong. But he's amazing in Dark Waters, the Todd Haynes movie.
Sure.
Totally forgot he was in that. That's true. Yeah.
I do think it's worth sort of talking for a second about where this falls in the Robert Altman arc, if you will. Emily, you mentioned that he was very angry up until this movie, and that's understandable. Popeye was sort of the notorious big swing that I've watched. I think I watched it, it might have been during the pandemic, which feels appropriate.
Yeah,
that movie's pretty gonzo, and understandable why people rejected it at the time. But
I mean, like, the thing about Altman is he would always be like, Popeye made money, and technically it did. Like, it did, like, but you know, it was like nobody at the time enjoyed it. I love it, to be
course
obviously,
you do.
But like,
do you have Popeye thoughts, Karina? Have you seen Popeye?
I've actually never seen it. It's just, yeah, it's something that. It has. I mean, it's like I've had opportunities to see it, and then something has always happened, and so it feels fated that I will never see it. But I was actually just like thinking when I was thinking about this movie after I rewatched it, like Altman has such a large filmography, and so few of his films compared to how many he made get revived. Mm-hmm. It's like there's so many of his films that I've never had an opportunity to see on a big screen, and I just, you know. somebody should let me program his full filmography.
Absolutely.
Short of like, I saw Gosford Park and I saw some of his last films in theaters because I was in a space where I could see it. And I've seen Nashville in a theater. But yeah, like most of the stuff I've seen has been on home video. Like, they just don't show his stuff.
Gosford, I definitely saw in the theater. It is interesting how, considering how much of a staple he is and how much people adore his films, it is odd that there has not been some sort of a resurgence stuff in theaters. I mean, post Papa, it is interesting. I mean, he is obviously enormous in the 70s, and the sort of late 60s, MASH, Brewster McCloud, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Long Goodbye. Nashville.
So many of those movies like bombed though at the time and now are like remembered fun, but like Nashville made its money back. MASH was a smash hit, but like, you know, Brewster McCloud at the time, nobody knew what to do with it.
I mean, Griffin Newman's favorite movie. I mean, it is very interesting how he sort of Popeye does. And again, it is so interesting. Popeye is 1980 and it does feel like, looking at the movie landscape now, Robert Altman deciding to do a Popeye movie sort of makes sense, right?
It's not ahead of his time.
It is. And then it's a stream of sort of, he does a movie called Streamers, which I've never heard of. Honor.
There's like adaptations of plays. Like this is, he can't get money to get movies made in the 80s. So he makes a lot of play adaptations that are really small scale. He does a lot of stuff. He does some stuff for TV. He's one of the early auteurs to do limited series. He does a bunch of stuff at HBO. It's mostly like him doing adaptations of plays with big enough stars, like Secret Honor. I think the star is Philip Baker Hall, who's burning down the
movie, right?
Yeah, but it's just him, you know? So like, it's a thing that Altman can get made because the budget's probably like $5. But like, the player is like the start of his new era, which is what he does until his death, which is, I'm going to get a bunch of big stars. They're all going to be in my movie in small parts and you're going to come see it. And most of them don't do well, but occasionally you have The Player or Gosford Park and they do, you know, blow up.
Yeah, I mean, Vincent and Leo, which comes out 2 years previous to The Player, was sort of, it felt like a little bit of an Oscar play, you know, two sort of juicy roles, but it doesn't really connect.
I had in my mind that he was doing strictly independent films in the 80s, and like a lot of them were independently financed, but they got studio releases, which is the thing that like they got acquired by like the MGMs of the world, which is, you know, interesting.
It is the sort of post-Player, you know, trajectory that you're talking about, Emily. He notoriously makes The Player to make Shortcuts. I mean, Shortcuts is the movie he really wants to make, the Raymond Carver, LA sort of short stories, all kind of interconnected, kind of an amazing movie. And I
strongly prefer that movie to The Player. I think Shortcuts is like astonishing.
I love Shortcuts. I mean, they're so different.
Altman is, when people ask me who my favorite filmmaker is, he's one of the three or four names I give.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
But like, I think there's two Altman modes. I think there's like MASH girlies and Nashville girlies, and I'm a Nashville girly. And like, he has a lot of like hard won cynicism in all of his films, but like, there is like a really darkly satirical Altman that I don't like as much as like, here's just a bunch of people living their lives and doing their thing, you know. But like The Player, like, I'm not gonna say The Player's not a fantastic film that's in my top 10 of 92. It's just, yeah, I prefer that other mode slightly.
Are you a Nashville or a MASH girly, Karina?
I like Nashville better than MASH, I would say. But I mean, I guess like my favorites of his are The Player, California Split, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Three Women.
Sure.
Yeah. And like, I don't think there's like a hard and fast delineation, but like, I do sort of look at it in terms of like, he does tend to have, you know, a big satire that's a hit, and then he'll do a little bit more like, here's a pointillized thing of a bunch of people living their lives, and like that doesn't do nearly as well. But so yeah, I mean, like I adore McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Three Women, and you know, there are some of his more, I like A Wedding, which is definitely him in a more satirical mode. Sure. It's not a movie a lot of people care about, but I do love that movie.
I think he's one of early filmmakers to really kind of deconstruct genre as well. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I do feel like he likes to sort of take the piss out of, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, notoriously sort of the anti-Western in its own way. It doesn't sort of fall into the you know, the bearing walls of that genre, if you will. And then if you look at sort of the last kind of run of his films, they're all kind of taking apart an industry or taking apart a genre of some sort, whether successfully or unsuccessfully. I mean, Prêt-à-porter is a notoriously mess of a movie, sort of him attempting to do kind of the player inside the fashion industry, if you will. But I think Kansas City is a great movie. People don't talk about Kansas City as much, the Jennifer Jason Leigh film, which I really love. I mean, then he tries a Grisham movie with the Gingerbread Man. Okay. No good, very bad. But what I the Gosford Park thing, I think, is really interesting because a movie that maybe someday Emily and I will talk about. But I do think that I remember the Oscars when Ron Howard wins Best Director for A Beautiful Mind. And yes, we're just giving a thumbs down, appropriately so. And the camera cuts to David Lynch getting up from his seat, walking over to Robert Altman and putting his arm around Robert Altman. And you're just like, these guys who, you know... It's insane that Ron Howard is winning an Oscar for that over the two of them.
I mean,
but it's like they're too good to win Oscars. David Lynch,
that is true,
and Robert Altman were just too good.
And it's like, but it's also like the thing is he also beats, if you're thinking about like more commercial filmmakers, he beats Peter Jackson for the first Lord of the Rings and Ridley Scott for Black Hawk Down. I don't really love Black Hawk Down, but like sure. I would rather any of those four people have an Oscar over Ron Howard. I like Ron Howard well enough.
He should have won it for Apollo 13 is ultimately what it comes down to. In my opinion, if you're going to give it to him. So, but that's neither here nor there. Gosford Park, which I think it's the last sort of great film he makes. I mean, he does The Company and Prairie Home Companion, which I actually quite like Prairie Home Companion. I think that movie's actually pretty great.
I prefer both of those to Gosford. I like Gosford a lot. But yeah, I think The Company's like sort of a secret masterpiece. Like,
it's interesting. Okay. I mean, I think the Prairie Home Companion, which, I mean, he was very sick and quite old while making that film. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great movie. I really do. But
what I love a last movie that mm-hmm. like, yes. The director kind of knows it's the last movie, but also they're like making plans for new ones. So they don't necessarily have that front of mind. You know, often when a director makes a movie knowing it's going to be their last film, it kind of stinks. Sure. Exception being John Huston's The Dead, which I think is like he was like on an oxygen tank. And I think that movie is gorgeous. but yeah, like Prairie Home Companion is one of my favorite final films because it feels like Robert Altman saying everything he wants to say about film and camaraderie and art and things like that, but also like you can tell he knows he's dying, and also like it feels like he's trying to figure out how to make one more. And
I'm going to give a little bit of context on The Player for our listeners. The synopsis is that certain that the anonymous threats he's been receiving are the work of David Kahane, played by Vincent D'Onofrio. Producer Griffin Mill, played by Tim Robbins, tries to fix things over cocktails. Instead, Griffin ends up murdering the screenwriter and courting the dead man's girlfriend, played by Greta Scacchi. It's Scotchy, right? I believe.
I've heard Scotchy and Scocky, but we used to say Scotchy in the 90s.
Okay, great. We'll go with. As police investigate, Griffin concentrates on a prestigious film that might reinvigorate his career, but he soon learns that David's demise hasn't been forgotten by everyone in Hollywood. The Player opened on April 10th, 1992, against Sleepwalkers, Basic Instinct, White Man Can't Jump, Beethoven, and Fern Gully.
Wow.
it would go on to make $28.9 million on an $8 million budget. It's got 97% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 84% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 4 stars, said Robert Altman's The Player, which tells Griffin's story with a cold sardonic glee, as a movie about today's Hollywood, hilarious and heartless in equal measure and often at the same time. It's about an industry that is run like an exclusive rich boys school where all the kids are spoiled and most of them have ended up here because nobody else could stand them. I mean, not a totally inaccurate representation of the film. I want to talk about this opening shot for a second because it feels like it's kind of oddly its legacy in a weird way, because it feels like, you know, Altman on the documentaries talks about, you know, all the various sort of rehearsals and the way that they shot this, and it is a great scene. The writers that are pitching within the scene, he just told them to pitch idea, like literally just came up with ideas. There's this kind of chaos, this beautiful chaos to the way that it's, which feels very emblematic of this industry. It's also very metatextual, where it's like got this, this sort of commentary inside it, where you've got Fred Ward talking about long shots and all this sort of stuff. It feels like the first time for me personally as a viewer when I was 12 or 13 that I was like, oh, I get what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And did you feel similarly, Karina, when you saw this for the first time? Did you feel like it was sort of this knowing kind of metatextual thing?
I don't know that I was that smart about it. I think for me it was a revelation in terms of technique and humor being combined.
Sure.
It was really, because I hadn't seen Touch of Evil before I'd seen this. You know, I hadn't seen a lot of the films that are being referenced. So it was more educational for me than me right. being able to be, oh, I see what they're doing.
Yeah. I remember I loved metatextual stuff, but I really needed it to be hit over the head with it sure. at that age. You know, like I love The Simpsons, but The Simpsons is very much like, here, we're doing a joke about the Fox Network. You're watching us on the Fox Network. Right. Do you get it? And like, that's one of the things I love about that show. But like, yeah, the thing that ripped my mind open in The Player is like the last 15 minutes, as opposed to this opening is like very, yeah, it's very, now I watched and I'm like, wow, what a like really smart metatextual thing, including sure. opening with the clapper for the film, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. doing the thing. Whatever the clapper clapping. But
the slate, is that what we're referring
the
slate.
to? I call it the clapper is what I call it. That's, and I'm an industry professional, so that's that's standard. And then the tracking shot, like that was a thing. That was like, I'd read about that before I'd seen the film. And what's fascinating is it's an amazing shot. It's an amazing, just in terms of choreographing the actors and all of that. But like when we think about like tracking shots now, they're like constantly in motion. And this one like is a bit more like a Spielberg one, or not yes. precisely, but it like stops on scenes and lets mm-hmm. the scenes play out and then pulls out and does another thing. And like, mm-hmm. I think it's amazing technical virtuosity. But I think when we think about tracking shots now, we think about like fucking Children of Men or something.
Sure. Yes. Or all of Birdman. For instance, for good or bad.
I try not to think about
Birdman, no, that's, so. I get that. I do think that the so I was when I pressed play and I was watching it the other day, I was thinking about there's a moment at the beginning of the tracking shot where an assistant picks up the phone, rings, picks up the phone, she's, I don't remember what she says, but her boss tells her, you always have him. You don't never, you know what I mean? You never say you don't, whatever. And I remember being an assistant and they train you literally to say, I'm sorry, I don't have them right now. Not that they're like, it's a weird semantic thing, but it's like, they're always there. They're just, you might not be able to actually get them on the phone, which is just so emblematic of this, in my opinion, this industry of like always trying to find this way to not, to not insult people, and the sort of the note behind the note and the words that are sort of what we were trying to say. Also, when I was on the show Station 19, we shot on the same lot as The Player. So seeing this lot was obviously fun, but, the pitches are amazing. Buck Henry pitching The Graduate 2, the new Graduate. Just
sexy, incredible. But with a stroke.
It's, I mean, Goldie goes to Africa, Out of Africa meets Pretty Woman, Ghost meets the Manchurian Candidate. Like these, they're truly incredible. It's also just, I was really kind of taken aback by how propulsive this movie is. Like it's really moving at a clip. It is
over 2 hours long, and it doesn't feel like it at all.
Absolutely. It's pretty incredible.
It kind of shifts genres every like 30 minutes, which I think really helps it. Like it's comedic and satiric throughout, but it is like, there's like a thriller and then there's like a Hitchcockian, how am I going to get away with it thing? And like, it just keep, and there's like a romance there. So it just keeps like shifting.
Absolutely.
Cynthia Stevenson. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I just saw her in this and was like, I love Cynthia Stevenson. Like she's never bad. And I went and looked her up and she just is not. Cynthia Stevenson deserves more work. I'm going to get her more.
There's little things. First of all, she's fantastic in this movie. And sort of watching these documentaries, they talk a lot about this quote unquote improvisational style that Altman has, which is we have a script, but we can deviate from it. And I kind of want to find the specialness of things that can just sort of happen. And it's why him and Tolkien, the writer of this film, did not get along particularly well. You know, Michael Tolkien, who wrote the novel that this was based on, felt as though they should be a little bit, I don't know, more precious about the words, shockingly. And Altman at a certain point was like, I only know one way to make a movie here. So I can either make it this way or, you know, we don't make this movie. But I think that's why all of these cameos feel so real, because they feel unscripted. I think about like the tension in the weird kind of awkward, if we've ever been, I'm sure we've all been in situations in this town where you cross paths with a famous person and you see the way people act around them and how awkward it can be. I think about the moment with John Cusack and Angelica Houston in particular in the restaurant. Where it's just like they don't want to talk to this guy. They have no interest in talking to Tim. No, none of these stars want to talk to Tim Robbins in this movie. It's incredible.
I mean, I love the Burt Reynolds scene.
Yeah.
And also that it's like the technical virtuosity of that scene, I think, gets overlooked because people are still, you know, wowed by the opening shots.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I agree. It is. The resentment that everyone has towards him in this film is palpable, and it's like water off a duck's back to him. I guess he's just like learned how to live with the fact that everyone hates him. it's pretty incredible.
I think this movie, like what I find interesting about this movie is that it leaves room for great art to be made within Hollywood and then mm-hmm. shows you all the people who don't particularly care about that and are willing to sell out. And like, that's mm-hmm. who the movie's about, but it'll be like, you know, here's like an actor who's like really cares about, you know, their work and like, it's a famous person, but then they're gone, you know, 3 seconds later. And I love that quality of like, this movie is satirical about a certain kind of Hollywood, but it also leaves you out of the out to be like, well, I'm not one of them. I'm one of the good ones.
No, for sure. It is very sort of, it's very obviously winky towards LA in terms of the perception of LA. Like I was thinking about LA Story versus this movie and how LA Story is much more sort of absurdist about this town. But there are things in this movie, like Griffin always asking for a different type of bottled water. It's always a different brand, so much so that they ran out of brands and they start making up brands at a certain point, which I think is just amazing. But like things like that, you know, this isn't a water glass, like just weird little sort of idiosyncratic things that he does to have the power dynamic that he wants, feels very emblematic of this town.
Yeah. And like, I think I think Shortcuts is a different view of LA in a way that like, I think so many LA movies are like so focused on the industry because obviously this is an industry town in many ways. It's like, you can't really make a DC movie that doesn't involve politics for an obvious counterexample. But like, I do love that. I do love like Shortcuts and Magnolia and some of these other movies that take in LA that is like less focused on the industry, even though it's always present. I think that felt more approachable to me when I was 14 or whatever, you know.
I do think it's interesting that so when Altman was asking all these people to show up, you know, for various bit parts and what have you, people kept asking, like, how did you get people to do this? And he said, I called them up and said, I'm making a film about a studio executive who murders a screenwriter and gets away with it. And they all just laughed and said, where do I need to be? Like, mm-hmm. I do think that there's this sort of acknowledgement of that, this David and Goliath kind of component that exists within this industry that I think people love too.
We all live in Los Angeles. I want to know your, like, the player moment in terms of, like, just intersecting with a famous person in a way that is, like, kind of absurdist. And I'm going to lead off because I have an answer.
Sure, sure.
When I was at Vox, I, like, had a meeting with a studio publicist or something, and we took it over lunch, which I did fairly frequently and always, you know, it was whatever. But I was sitting there eating, and we were talking about all these movies they wanted me to cover, or TV shows they wanted me to cover, that I was probably not going to write about and go on set visits to Budapest or whatever. And, like, I'm sitting there, and sitting across from me is Shailene Woodley with probably her manager or agent. And she, like, is at a point where her career is in kind of a low ebb. This is after that last Divergent movie gets canceled. You know, she's not, like, she doesn't have a lot going on. It's right before Big Little Lies. And she's, like, crying. She's in, like, an existential spiral. But people keep walking up to her and being like, hey, I loved you. And she has to, like, immediately brighten and be like, thanks so much. Thank you. And then they'll go away and she'll be right back to crying. And I was just, like, in awe of her. And, like, I think I watched her too closely and she was aware of this. But, like, I just, like, was, you know, I was amazed at watching a very good actor in real time do that for people who kept walking up to her.
I mean, that's an amazing, I certainly don't think I have anything that sort of in the same way crystallizes the you're always on-ness of being an actor or a famous person. I'm sure that Karina, you have lots of stories, but I totally get it if you don't want us to share them on mic.
I mean, yeah, I shared them. Go ahead.
The only thing that came to mind, I guess, because I just told this story to somebody, was, like, Darren Aronofsky cut in line in front of me at the Oscars. It's like, I don't know if people know this, but, like, in order to, like, get your picture taken on the red carpet at the Oscars or the Golden Globes or whatever, you have to, like, stand in line. And it's not, like, it's not just me who has to stand in line. It's everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in line, you know, with my husband who's nominated, and Kate Hudson and Jesse Buckley and, you know, other famous people. And Darren Aronofsky doesn't want to wait in line. So he just, like, starts, like, making conversation with, like, one person after another. God. And, like, ultimately, like, it's like we have been waiting in line for almost an hour. And he, you know, comes up to us and, like, you know, pretends to, like, start have a conversation with us so that he could get his picture taken before us.
Wow.
Classy.
Chuck Lorre did that to me at a valet stand once.
Yeah, patience doesn't seem to be something that a lot of famous people have in this town, so it's unfortunately not particularly surprising. But it I mean, I do think as well that this movie kind of, I'm trying to think of its relationship with the cameos and the fame that exists within it, and it does feel very sort of, it's kind of a loving perspective of them. Like, I don't think it's particularly snide about the movie stars. Would you agree? Like, it doesn't feel like it's taking a shot at them.
I think it sort of depends on the star. But
yeah. Fair. Fair enough.
Yeah. It does feel a little bit like it's tweaking Burt Reynolds a bit, but he was at that stage in his career where he didn't mind tweaking himself. You know, the fact that he was on, at this point, he's on Evening Shade. Like, he's, right, you know, his career is at kind of a low ebb. So, like, I think he's, and also, like, the two stars it kind of is gently mocking the most are Julia Roberts and Bruce Willis, but they're at a stage in their career where they don't mind being in on the joke a little bit because they're so big that, like, the joke is going to make them seem more accessible to us.
I agree with that. I also think it should be said that apparently Michael Tolkien, the writer of this film, has been asked to option habeas corpus on several occasions, which I think is amazing. Habeas corpus being the film within the film that is this hacky, terrible fucking, I mean, it's amazing.
They
should make habeas corpus.
What's really funny, though, is, like, do you make it the way that they originally pitch it, or do you make it the way that they ultimately make it?
Richard E. Grant's pitch is tremendous. But, yeah.
It should be like when Rennie Harlan and Paul Schrader both made Exorcist prequels because, like, they didn't like Paul Schrader, so they had Rennie Harlan make one too. They should do, like, the straight up pitch of habeas corpus, and then they should do the, like, glitzier version and just see what happens. That's what they should do.
Antonio Campos or Sean Durkin, either one of them for the original pitch, and then who for, like, maybe, like, Sean Levy for the other one.
That sounds great. Yeah.
Sounds perfect. Yeah. That's incredible. I mean, I do think that So for our listeners, basically,
to cut in, Phil, I think it needs to be Sean Durkin and Sean Levy so they can say, like, they Sean's? Can do press that's like, we're the Sean's, but we spell it differently.
Yeah.
That's not the only thing we do differently.
I do think that Richard E. Grant's pitch that it's no stars, that she dies at the end, that it's all the things that this industry has no interest in doing. I mean, I don't know why we'd make that movie, though. Like, I just genuinely don't even know, other than just like thumbing his nose at, you know, Hollywood. It is hilarious to me that he thinks that under any circumstances, anyone would want to make this movie.
You mean the Richard E. Grant character?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But I mean, I don't know. I think that what actually ends up happening in terms of like Tim Robbins's character being like, I'm going to use this to fuck Peter Gallagher, yes, is fantastic.
100%. Perfect. For sure.
You're too industry pilled, Phil. I think that in the back of my brain, I have so many ideas that I'm like, we can't have any fucking stars, and it's got to have the ending that's true to the material. And then like, I know that like inevitably what would happen is like, we'd make it and we'd have to get like a star. But like, I can see what's going on in this guy's brain when he pitches it that way. And then the flip is very funny where he's like, but it tested poorly and wherever. But you know, it is a little bit like, trouble reconciling those two guys with each other beyond the satiric point that's being made. You know what I mean?
No, for sure. Yeah. I mean, So The Guardian did a really interesting piece a few years ago on The Player. I just wanted to read a small portion of it because it feels like it's on point with what we're talking about here. Looking at the state of the movie business today, it's hard not to feel that the Larry Levy's of the world are now in charge. Franchise filmmaking, the dominant movie trend of our time, inherently devalues the writers and empowers the producers. Nowadays, the struggle between commerce and art isn't decided by office politics and individual greed. It's the cold, hard economics of the global marketplace and corporate synergy. What does play well today is Altman's outright refusal to blame it all on the suits. The Player wraps up with a contrived happy ending his characters don't deserve, reminding us again of the phoniness and implicitly pointing its criticisms back at the viewer. The enemy in a film like this is the audience, Robert Altman said. If people don't go see these manufactured films, they're not going to get made. It's a bit like a bully hitting you with your own fist, asking you all the time why you're punching yourself, but he's not wrong. His equal opportunity approach to the satire, Altman even admitted that he sees himself much in Griffin, is what makes The Player so endearing. It pinpoints the beaten, bloodied state of American decency at the end of the 20th century and blames us all for the carnage. I do think there's something to all of that. The line that really jumps out at me is the enemy of the film of a film like this is the audience. And I do think that watching this film through the lens of 2024 now, that's kind of the thing that really kind of hit me the hardest, is the Larry Levy scene in the boardroom with the newspaper being like, why do we need writers? I can fucking do this. It feels very AI too, of sort of where we are right now with all of that stuff.
If AI was Peter Gallagher, I'd be a lot cooler with AI. I'd
just be like, when we remake The Player, Robert Gallagher will be an AI.
Yeah, you know, in the film AI, when there's that enormous Einstein head voiced by Robin Williams, let's just have it be Peter Gallagher. Peter Gallagher.
I mean, Karina, watching this again through sort of a 2024 lens, how did it hit you in terms of how sort of how much it sort of saw this coming?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my view of Hollywood history is cyclical, is that everything is cyclical. And so, you know, this conversation of like, you know, what do we need writers for? Like, that was happening in the late silent era. Like there were certainly some writers who wrote silent movies, but by the time, like, you know, 1925, 1926, the studios were consolidating as corporations. What had been kind of a Wild West had already become reduced down to like six or seven companies. And at that point, they were trying to cut writers out of the process. And then sound came along and they were like, all right, we'll get some people from New York who know how to write dialogue. And so like these things happen over and over again. Then the same things happen over and over again. They just, you know, are wearing different clothes.
Yeah, you look at this movie and it's like, anxious about a certain kind of like ascendancy in studio executives who are kind of cynical and, you know, just want to don't necessarily want to like put in the work. But I do think what's interesting is like Larry, the Peter Gallagher character, is like the stories he's pitching based on those newspaper articles are cynical and like exploitative in many ways, but also like they could make interesting movies if you had like people who were passionate about telling those stories. And like, I think we're in a similar moment of existential dread about the industry for many different reasons. But like, if you may, you could make a movie like this, and a lot of the satiric points would be roughly similar. They just have different targets.
Although I would say that even the bad version of Habeas Corpus is better than most movies that studios are releasing right now. Yeah. You know, like a sexy Stand and Deliver with Jimmy Smits. Like, I would prefer to see that than almost any movie that has been released in 2024 so far.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can like, you can feel the flop sweat right now when the things that hit all through the 2010s are starting to really crumble. And like, you know, the Barbie Oppenheimer thing has been discussed to death, but you do sort of feel the studios being like, where the fuck did that come from? What do we do now? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that, I mean, we're in a weird time right now. It does feel like shifting sands and all that. And I cling to the hope of what you're talking about, that it is cyclical and that it will come back around. I do think that, you know, the inherent problem, or one of the things that you do sense from this, is just kind of laziness, this sort of path of least resistance, which is so inherent to this business in terms of,
it's inherent to every business, though. I mean, that's capitalism, is like, how do we make the most amount of money with the least amount of effort? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what ends up happening with Hollywood as it goes through these cycles is that, you know, you get to a point where everything stops working. And so then, you know, that's when there's an openness to, you know, maybe try something new, because you can't, there's nothing left to lose. And then as soon as like a new formula is constituted, that's when the risk taking goes away.
I really feel like you're seeing the early stages of that. And like, Poor Things made a lot of money. How the fuck did Poor Things make a lot? You know, 5 years ago, Poor Things would have, you know, made a respectable $15 million or something.
Yep.
It's like, there, it does feel like we're sort of in a sea change. The people who are going to see movies in theaters are more interested in being challenged, even by like blockbuster fare. And then the stuff that, you know, we ostensibly wanted from back when, like Disney is flailing because they can't seem to figure out how to make a thing that isn't based on an IP they own. So it is like a really fascinating time for that. I had another point to make, but I've forgotten it. So I'm just going to butt in when you're saying something, Phil, and I'll just say it.
Yeah, yeah. I'll just say. A line that I think about, honestly, probably monthly from this film. Can we talk about something other than Hollywood for a change? We're educated people, and then they all just start laughing.
Yeah,
it is. To me, that is just, I mean, I've been there. I feel that way a lot of the time. It's perfect. There's also people there's a whole cast of people in this movie that are all fantastic. Sidney Pollack shows up as Griffin's lawyer, who's just a great actor. I'm always happy when Sidney Pollack is on screen. You have obviously Whoopi Goldberg, who's fantastic, who is instrumental in this film's funding. She's coming off of, she has Sister Act this year. She has her Oscar win for Ghost a couple years previous.
I think maybe the one meta thing I was aware of the first time that I saw this movie was that when she picks up the Oscar and says it's heavy, like, you know, she had very recently won an Oscar.
Absolutely. You've Dean Stockwell, who's fantastic, Richard E. Grant, Fred Ward, who I mentioned earlier. I want to talk about the Greta Scacchi character for a second, because if I have one note about this movie, it's that I do feel like her character is kind of short shrift a little bit, and is kind of this.
A woman in a Hollywood satire gets short shrift.
I know.
I agree with you. And also, I think it's like a really interesting level of metatextuality that I can't be too upset by it, you know?
Well, it's interesting because Altman talked a lot in the documentary about her being this, not a metaphor so much as like a fantasy, like Griffin's fantasy woman, for lack of a better way of putting it. And that is why she has almost this like ethereal kind of quality to her. She feels sort of mysterious and we don't really understand her. I just find her kind of annoying, quite honestly. But I just, I don't. Do you guys? What are your thoughts on June Goodman's daughter?
I have two thoughts.
Yeah,
one
please.
Is that she's like kind of a proto Manic Pixie Dream Girl, except that she's an adult woman, which yes. I find sort of interesting. Mm-hmm. And the other, I don't know if either of you have read the novel. I haven't read it recently. I read it a few years ago, but and quite a bit in the movie is different from the novel. But one thing that I remember being pretty similar is this character. I think he does it more in the novel than he does it in the movie. But Griffin keeps trying to confess to her, and she's like, "I don't want to hear it." Like, and yeah. In a way, that is part of his fantasy, you know, of like, what if I maybe like the route to getting away with this is just like being around people who don't want to. Who don't want to know, you know?
Sure.
And so I think for me, I feel like I understand that character and I understand how she works in the puzzle piece of what this movie is trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that like this is a movie in which you could like have the experience of, you know, genuine romantic feeling. So it works for me, but.
That's yeah. fair. I hear that. Yeah. Yes,
I'm normally the person to be like the ladies don't get enough of a point of view in this film, but like I think that's kind of the point of what they're doing with her. I agree that like an actual romance is not possible within these circumstances. The scene I like best with her is when he's talking to her on the phone and like looking at her through the window, and yeah. It's like such a like creepy but memorable image. I guarantee you, given the current state of film media, if this movie came out right now, I was thinking about this last night, there would be like 10 billion pieces about how he actually dies from the rattlesnake, because everything after that moment is like everything kind of works out for him. And like sure. He gets the girl, he gets the job, he gets away with the crime. But yeah, what if he died from the rattlesnake?
What if he died?
Somebody at like whatever former Gawker property is still clinging to life support. Write that article.
I agree with you guys 100% that everything of this film is with intent. I don't believe that sort of that she's quote unquote written poorly without good reason for putting it that, you know, I mean, I agree with you, Emily. I love the sort of almost predatorial scene of him outside the house, outside the window on his cell phone. I also love, you know, Altman's use of sound design, the way voices sound in his films. And I love how June's voice is through the phone and it sounds like it's through a phone as opposed to how crystal clear it always is. I love all of that. I think her art sucks personally.
I think it's supposed to.
Maybe.
Because if she can't do anything, she can't be doing anything professionally or creatively that will be a threat to Griffin.
That's true.
You know, like Griffin is like not a talented person creatively, but he does figure out this way to like play men off of each other so that he wins.
Sure.
If he was like involved with a woman who actually had creative talent, like that's not what he's looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree with that for sure.
He needs to be a guy who has like three kids with her. And then 10 years from now when she's exhausted and she's like, I just feel like I haven't done anything. And he's cheating on her with someone. He can be like, well, why don't you get back to your art? And she'll be like, ah, you know, like that's what he wants.
Yeah. I mean, Karina, you brought up the confession thing, which feels like a way to talk about the sex scene for a second, which obviously with your erotic series and us having talked about Basic Instinct and Consenting Adults, everyone's favorite film of 1992. Uh-huh. So this sex scene, I think, is fascinating for a couple of reasons. The first is it's shot the way it's shot because Greta was pregnant at the time and she didn't want to be fully nude. So that's why this sex scene is shot so close up. But it's a great sex scene because of that. It's one of those quote unquote happy mistakes where, you know, Altman's forced into a corner to do a thing, and it creates this sort of, I love how thin the focus is, sort of floating in and out of focus, the sweatiness of it, the music, him trying to confess to this murder and her being like, I don't want to, obviously not a great time to confess to a murder, but sort of, what are your thoughts on this sex scene and what sort of, you know, it wrought?
You know, in my memory, I always conflate it with a mud bath.
Sure.
And like have this memory of it, like they're fucking in mud, which they're like, they are not literally, but they sort of are.
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, I think it is a really good distillation of, like I said, like something that is a theme in the novel of like like the his happy ending is having a completely superficial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And like it, she becomes the right woman for him because she's like, I don't want to know.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it is just also, you know, sex scenes, I feel like more times than not, do not actually convey the intimacy of the act itself. And I do think that this does. I think that it does feel very intimate. It feels like these two people bearing their soul away, certainly him. And I think that part of it is because it's not particularly graphic, which I think can distract people from what's actually trying to be conveyed. I think that the scene just is so much more powerful unintentionally in a weird way. And Altman takes credit for it in years later. It's like, yeah, that was always what I intended to do. But
although, I mean, speaking of graphic, you do see like a tiny flash of Robin's penis when he gets out of the mud.
You do.
There's like, I think that what's I think what's interesting about this movie's approach to intimacy is like the actual sex scene, the intimacy is emotional, and the intimacy we see between Robbins and Stevenson and then Robbins
yes.
and Scotchy is they like are naked around each other when they're doing other things, you know? So the nudity is not really in the sex because what's intimate about sex is emotional connection. But then when you're emotionally connected to someone, you can just be naked all the time is my takeaway from this movie.
Sure. Yeah. No, that feels right. Also just in a weird bit of trivia, Vincent D'Onofrio and Greta Scacchi were in a relationship while making this film and their daughter, Lila George is married to Sean Penn. So there you go. That's just a little bit of weird, 6 degrees of I don't know what.
Is it the daughter that Greta Scacchi's pregnant with in this film?
Not sure. Can't speak to that. Not I don't know. Maybe.
I'm gonna look this up.
You should look that up.
Horrified.
I just think
at least she didn't marry Tim Robbins.
That's true. That's true. I just part of the June thing.
Oh my god, it was. Oh yeah. Yeah. They're divorced now, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oof. Part of the June thing. Does seem kind of pretentious. She is pretentious. There is just kind of this, the way she speaks at times. I don't like words and letters. I like words and letters. I'm not crazy about completeness. Like, what is that even? What are we getting at here, June? What exactly are you trying to say? It's stuff like that that kind of drives me a little bit mental about her. But I do think that her and Robbins have good chemistry, which I do think is, you know, obviously vital to this.
God. Layla yes. George was on Animal Kingdom, the TV show, which a friend of mine was showrunner for a little while. So I should just see.
I really just sent you down a rabbit hole.
She's in Mortal Engines. She's my favorite actor of all time.
Mortal Engines is great. I love the scenes of the watching the dailies. All those sort of scenes of like dailies are on. They're barely paying any attention to what's being screened. They're really just talking to each other or asking for bottled water or whatever the fuck. Like, they're just not really paying any attention. I think all those scenes are fantastic. And I love Griffin not knowing who Joe Gillis is. Like, these are just all things that feel so emblematic that I love. I do feel like the... So what are your feelings about the thriller components of the movie, like the actual murder tension? Is Griffin's life in danger? Does that stuff work for you, or does it feel like it's kind of winky and not really sort of fully engaging?
Can I say both?
Sure.
Like, it is like the scenes where it needs to be a thriller, it more or less works. And then the scenes in between them, it like kind of doesn't matter, because I do buy that for this guy, it kind of doesn't matter. He only thinks about death when it's directly staring him in the face.
Sure.
And then, you know, when a guy's threatening him and he's like, I don't know, this guy's threatening me, but there's a snake in his car. He freaks the fuck out. Like, he thinks he's found the guy who's threatening him. He like freaks mm-hmm. the fuck out. But in between, sure. he's just kind of like, I'm living a charmed existence, because he is.
I don't know that. I mean, yeah. I think that he's not that concerned about like actually dying, because he's afraid of being dead in this town.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, so, sure. you know, that's really kind of what is occupying his attention. And like, that is more important mm-hmm. than like life or death. I think maybe the stuff of I don't know that I really believe that somebody's trying to kill him, but I do believe, I do feel really, I think what is really effective is this thing of like, I killed the wrong guy.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I do get the, I think he's genuinely worried that the law is going to come for him, like that there's going to be consequences to his actions and that the walls are closing in, I think is done really effectively. And that's almost worse to him. Like what people will say about him is almost worse than anything.
I don't think this is the intent of the film, but watching it through the lens of the post Harvey Weinstein era, sure. It's like really, I really was thinking about how much there were so many executives who had things they were desperately trying to keep covered up that came to light in that period. But also then like how it sort of flipped where the whole thing was like, well, if you say like a bad thing about someone or you accuse them of a thing that's not like a crime, but is kind of nebulously wrong, like sure. That you're worse than them. And like, I'm like, I was like fascinated by that flip, and the player kind of like lives in that tension of like, yeah, this guy's committed murder, but also what he's most worried about is like, you know, people not what people will say. Yeah.
He's also committed murder, but then he manages to save a movie called Habeas Corpus.
Yes. And there is, you know, to tap into this sort of what will people say, this movie kind of like looks down its nose at things like Pasadena, for instance, like the city of Pasadena feels like some sort of like the idea of going to Pasadena, dying in Pasadena, all these sort of things, I think are just I just think it's really funny.
I love Pasadena.
Pasadena's lovely. Pasadena. I don't have anything against Pasadena.
Yeah, I actually don't think the movie looks down its nose at Pasadena. I think Griffin does. And like,
that's true.
You know, and that he has to like, you know, it's, you know, it's like embarrassing that like there's cops from Pasadena at the studio.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But I think the movie actually like, I think the movie is somewhat empathetic with Whoopi and her team.
Yes. Oh, for sure.
Like the one time we see a real movie, it's The Bicycle Thieves, one of the great films of all time. And then we're seeing it in a grand old movie palace in Pasadena, which sadly is closed now. And it's now a church.
Was the Rialto closed?
It's a church. It has been since 2007. It's a church now. Yeah. We could go to church there though. So,
I mean, that sounds interesting. That could be interesting. I mean, it looks like a beautiful theater. Vincent D'Onofrio is a baby. He looks like a completely different human, but he's great in this. You know, I think that the murder scene is classically Altman in the way that it's staged, the way that it's the lighting, and that all of it just has this very sort of, I don't know, one kind of dialed upness that makes it feel just a little heightened, that I love. The Whoopi, you mentioned sort of Whoopi and her cohorts, La Lovett. Did Julia and La Lovett meet on this movie? Is that when they met, or were they already dating at that point?
They either met on this or Prêt-à-Porter.
Okay, it must have been this, because
but she's barely in this, and she's not in like a scene with him.
When did they get married?
He met her on the set of The Player.
Oh, they okay,
which is wild because I don't think they're in the same. Yeah,
they're not in
that
scene.
At the rap party or something.
Yeah.
They were married for what, like a hot minute, basically, like 5 seconds?
Less than 2 years. They got married in June 93 and divorced in March 95. So
what a couple. I love it. It's such a weird couple. It's the best.
I remember when people were like, Lyle Lovett's so sexy. And I'd be like, really? Because I hadn't seen him in anything. And then I watched this and I'm like, yeah, there's like a weird sex appeal there.
Is there?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. He just kind of has that thing where you're like, he might have some nerves that aren't quite working. And like, you love that for him. Like, it's just like, there's like a thing that he feels sort of like fearless that I don't know. Okay. I'm just explaining my sexuality on this podcast.
I think the rattlesnake scene is great. I love that Griffin has a fax machine in his car, which is just incredible. The scene where he goes over to June's, Griffin, and start like just pours his heart out. Tim Robbins is great in that scene. I love that scene exists because in a lesser movie, I don't think you would have that scene of Griffin feeling genuine remorse and fear and yeah, I just I think that June is kind of dismissive of him in that moment, but I do think that he's really good in that scene.
Well, so I think he thinks that he's just trying to fuck her, which is like,
yes, yes.
I think it is ambivalent or ambiguous as to whether he is just trying to fuck her or if he is sure. like really scared and thinks that she's the only person he can go to.
Yeah. I mean, I also feel as though part of it is I do think he's falling for her, right? Mm-hmm. Like this construct of a person, because I don't really know her, obviously. But so I do think that there is this. It's kind of the only time that you really feel like the suit of armor has come down and that Griffin is maybe being human for a second. But yes, yeah,
what's that movie that it's Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan, and like Zoe Kazan is like a woman he wrote
Ruby
into
Sparks.
Existence? Yeah, not a great movie, but it nope. does sort of feel like Greta Scott. She is like the Ruby Sparks of this universe. Like,
I mean, Ruby Sparks is a perfect distillation of a literal manic pixie dream girl that like, a writer like literally
David,
writes.
It feels like David Kinane wrote her into existence. And then he dies, and she's sure, like, sure. "Well, I guess I'll just attach.
I guess I'll just exist now." Yeah. The first scene at the police station when Griffin goes there, and that whole sort of apparently all the tampon stuff was made up and Whoopi was just kind of riffing. All of that scene of her getting under his skin is so well done. The one of us, the laughing. I mean, it's just, it's all fantastic. Mm. It's an amazing scene. I really like
the other actress who works at the police station. And I don't know mm-hmm. that I've ever seen her in anything else.
I haven't seen her in anything else either. But yeah, there's just something I also just love. It's at the beginning of the scene. Griffin walks in and walks immediately into the office. And she's like, where the fuck is he going? Like, go get it's got such a great energy of Tim Robbins trying to construct a scene from a movie mm-hmm. and playing by the rules of a movie and them not playing by those rules. And it's caught him completely off guard and he doesn't know how to deal. It's fantastic. The lineup scene later in the film where he goes back to the police station is hilarious, where the one eyewitness picks Lyle Lovett as the person she saw.
And Whoopi is like, are you sure?
And she keeps pointing her towards Griffin. And there's also, she's like, I'll swear on my grandmother's grave or whatever. And she's like, where the fuck is your grandmother buried? It's great. Yeah, I mean, it is. I respect that this film weirdly plays by the rules of a sort of thriller, and yet at the same time is bucking it and fucking with it. But I think that to kind of come back to what we were talking about earlier, Emily, with sort of Altman's career at large, it's like sometimes he has a mystery or a script or sort of the kind of spine of a thing that people can hold on to, and those films tend to connect better, quote unquote, than the ones that are a little bit more freeform.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is sort of the beginning of that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I don't, it's a, I prefer the slightly more freeform, but I get why, like, you know, this movie has a plot. It's a weird plot and it's a meandering plot, but like it is definitely, it conforms to a structure, even if it's kind of like a four act structure. And I think that's, I don't know. I love that for it, but I'm also, you know, I like when Robert Altman's just like, I'm just going to put a camera down and a bunch of people are going to stand in front of it and say, thanks.
I am. So at the end of the film, there's a moment where Bonnie, the Cynthia Stevenson character, her heel snaps on her shoe and she kind of stumbles, and then she like takes off her shoes essentially and walks into Griffin's office begging for her job because Larry Levy has fired her. So that shoe breaking moment happened on the first take by accident, and Altman loved it, and then somehow Stevenson had to make it happen like 10 more times.
Wow.
Which I think is pretty incredible. It obviously looks incredibly real.
This is why she's one of our best actors.
She's so good in this movie.
You cared about crying on cue. She can heel break on cue.
She can heel break on cue. I do that. the Bonnie is the character that obviously you feel the most sorry for at the end of this film. She gets fired. She's sort of chewed up and spit out by this industry, by Griffin. Griffin won't even take a meeting with her, basically hustles past her and says, "You're going to land on your feet, Bonnie. I know it. You're a fighter." As she cries on the steps of his office. Do we think Bonnie makes it, guys?
I hope that Bonnie just, like, you know, went to grad school and, right. Wrote a novel.
Yeah.
Bonnie got the fuck out of Dodge. Bonnie has big, goes to graduate school, gets her PhD and becomes a professor of film energy. Like, that's my dream for her. She's like teaching at UCLA. I think she'd be a great UCLA professor.
She also teaches a course on Harry Belafonte because she's such a huge fan.
That party scene's really good too.
There's
so much that's good in this movie.
there is something very kind of some of the cameos, like Jack Lemmon, for instance, just playing a piano, almost looking at the camera, it seems at one point. it does have this sort of messy energy to kind of, I think, what you're eliciting of, like, just this kind of, it feels like a Hollywood party. It just feels like people are just kind of Jeff Goldblum with, I don't know who he's with, but
he's being like trapped on the stairs by the Peter Gallagher character, which is really funny because, like, there's like some universe where, like, Jeff Goldblum and Peter Gallagher could have played brothers, or like Peter Gallagher is like the TV version of Jeff Goldblum, maybe.
Yeah. And I always forget that, like, Jeff Goldblum, like, his first big role is in Nashville. And, like, I always forget that until I watched it again. I'm like, oh, right. He's a guy who rides around on a tricycle in this movie.
Yeah. All the cameos are obviously really well done and funny, but that party scene in particular, it's Sidney Pollack's character who's having this party, and I don't know, I really love it. I also think the very end of this film, Griffin is getting pitched the idea for basically the movie we've just watched. Mm-hmm. Which on the DVD, Tim Robbins claims was his idea, that he pitched to Altman the end of this movie. And Altman laughed and said, "I'll never give you credit for it," which I think is amazing. And I hope is true. I can't imagine this movie without this ending. It is sort of baffling to me. I know it's not how the book ends, correct, Karina?
Yeah, it's not.
It just feels like it has to be this ending. It's insane that it was ever not this ending.
Does the book have a, like, clear answer to the crimes at the center of it, or crimes, air quotes?
Yes, I believe so. Right.
My memory is that it doesn't, but I haven't read it in a while.
When we're talking about, like, me watching this movie as kind of a very young movie buff, that ending was the part that broke my brain open, because it was like, yeah, call it The Player. And I was like, I'm watching The Player right now.
How is that possible? Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of a perfect ending. You mentioned earlier, Emily, that you could figure out who the person is. It's the guy at the funeral.
At the funeral, yeah. And, like, right. apparently, like, Robert Altman said this in the DVD commentary for the Laserdisc, which we shouldn't even call it a DVD commentary, because DVD hadn't been invented yet. But, like, he said it in that commentary, and other people have picked up that it's the same voice. But also, like, it's kind of cheeky. You're not sure if it's really true, but, like, that's if you get to the end of this movie and you're like, but who was the stalker? I don't know that you've watched it correctly, but that is, like, the answer if you really wanted to know.
But I understand why people, like, would not absorb that information, because that funeral is, like, I mean, nobody has fun at a funeral, but that funeral seems like a real drag, because, like,
real bummer.
The speakers are just so pretentious, and, like, you know, there's just, like, writers who, like, are probably there just because they're not working at, like, that day.
Just, it, like, really, yeah, feels,
okay,
that
I'll,
way.
I'll come down to this funeral on a Wednesday.
It very much, like,
I think it's Hollywood Forever too, right? That is that where it is? Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't know if it's Hollywood Forever or not. Okay. Yeah.
For a movie that is, like, ostensibly about an executive killing a writer, I mean, that's what it's about, but, like, you sort of, the satire you understand in that is that writers always get the boot in Hollywood. Like, this movie is also very funny about writers. It just, like, really takes, it really, like,
it
takes,
really goes out. Us.
It's like, when they read the excerpt from David's, like, screenplay, you're like, what the fuck is this?
What is this fucking thing? Also, the script that he wrote about, like, going to Japan when he was a college grad or something like that. I'm just like, what is this? What is this movie? There's a reason why they didn't want to make this movie. But I do love the sort of obviously the cyclical nature of the end of the film, where he basically gets pitched the movie that we've just watched. He drives up to his house and it's this fantasy, idyllic, you know, garden, and June is pregnant. I love the na 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 that you hear before the like music swells into this like beautiful sort of over the top score. It also should be said that the art director has constantly gotten shit from florists because the flowers that are in that garden, you would never have those flowers together. Like they can't actually coexist in that garden together, which I think actually makes the fantasy that much better, but it was unintentional.
It's just like how newspaper critics got so mad about the final season of The Wire. I didn't know that florists had a grudge against the player.
They got an axe to grind. They're just like, those flowers wouldn't be together.
Now I want to go on florist Reddit. Read all about it.
Which I just think is tremendous. But I mean, just to rewind very quickly, just to the habeas corpus sequence that we see the I guess it's the sort of they're screening the final cut of the film for the executives, and we see Julia Roberts is about to be gassed in the gas chamber, and then Bruce Willis comes in and just like blasts out the windows with a shotgun, which and then everyone just starts covering. I'm like, yeah, you shouldn't be breathing in this toxic air.
Also, Tim Robbins's longtime partner Susan Sarandon is in habeas corpus.
Of course she is.
Falk. I want to see this fucking movie.
I know.
What I love about it is just like the casting of Julia Roberts and Bruce Willis. You see how this movie slowly got taken away from its original vision. Like, you know, the initial thing was like, we need some stars in this movie. And then they get some big stars who like want to win Oscars. And it's just like, you can see how that sort of slippery slope happened to where Richard E. Grant is like, but it tested terribly in Canoga Park.
I mean, Richard E. Grant, who is just at 11 through this entire movie, is just so over the top, just absolutely amazing. I also think, too, it's funny that I don't think that Bruce and Julia are in another film until Ocean's 12, which
together.
I think is they're together.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which I think is funny just because that movie is in its own way, just this weirdo, like that they're in a scene together, but technically it's a whole weird thing. But yeah. I just kind of love that knowingness that they're in two scenes together in two movies that are knowingly making fun of movies. I think it's
and making
funny.
Fun of them as stars.
Absolutely.
We're all agreed that Ocean's 12 is the best Ocean's film, right?
That's I can't
a consensus
get on the train.
Opinion.
No. I like 12, but I can't get on that crazy train. Do you have thoughts, Karina?
I like them all. I actually think that it's like kind of like maybe like one of the better trilogies in Hollywood history. But I think the first one is kind of a perfect movie. And then I like 12 and 13 for different reasons.
Yeah, I do love them all. It is a very Emily opinion that 12 is my favorite.
It is the most Emily opinion. I would expect nothing less of you, Emily, than to think 12 is the best of the series. But I do just think that Julia and Bruce doing this move, doing the player at this moment in their careers, and sort of kind of stepping away from Hollywood for a bit there, I feel like. Wasn't this around that time where she took a break? Am I making this up?
I think this is kind of in between a bunch of flops.
The break might be more like
94. And then the comeback is My Best Friend's Wedding in 95.
Yes. Yes, you are correct. She does Sleeping with the Enemy, Dying Young, and Hook in 91. And she does this in 92. Pelican Brief is 93. So yeah, you're right. It's not much of a break at all. And then, yeah, Prêt-à-Porter, I Love Trouble, Something to Talk About, Mary Riley, Michael Collins. Oof,
Collins is dark days. I am a big Something to Talk About defender, though. I think
I've only seen it once, but it's good. Yeah, and then obviously My Best Friend's Wedding is 97, and then it's, you know, she's back. But yeah, it's just interesting. And then Bruce, who at this point, Bonfire of the Vanities and Hudson Hawk, is sort of licking his wounds a little bit at this point, which I think
until Pulp Fiction.
I do think, you know, in the Ebert review, he talks about how the player is what Bonfire of the Vanities wanted to be.
It's so different. I mean, it's like, yeah. I you know, I think one of the reasons why Bonfire of the Vanities doesn't work is because Hollywood doesn't understand New York. Like, you know, maybe in the '70s, like you had guys who had lived there and could make that movie. And I'm sure Brian De Palma like had spent some time in New York, but like there's so much against like making, like capturing like what that novel is trying to say about New York. Like it's, there's so many reasons why it's impossible to do it in a Hollywood movie.
Right. No, that makes sense. I mean, it's also terribly miscast on top of everything else. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of problems with that movie, obviously.
But I think Bruce is kind of the best part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
That's one I watched over the pandemic because I was I just want to watch some bad movies. And I liked Bruce in it quite a bit, actually. He's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
He feels like the only one who understands what movie he's in is ultimately what it comes down to. But there's books written about this movie being, so if you want to know about Bonfire of the Vanities, there's no shortage of stuff for our listeners to check out. But it is a fascinating, maybe one of the more fascinating movie disasters, if you will. But
I think, as someone who loved that book, it does feel like it's unadaptable to a film. It does feel like a pretty classic, this should be a miniseries thing. But at the time, you know,
they're trying to do it as a miniseries now.
They should say, really? Should not.
You know, but who's trying though? You know who has the rights to it is Chuck Lorre.
Whoa. Now I want to see it. That sounds
good. Is he going to use the Kaminsky method in directing it?
To adapt it? Possibly.
I hope there's a whole section about him cutting in front of me in a valet line.
Speaking of TV, I just want to very briefly talk about the fact that there was a pilot of this movie that they tried to adapt for television that did not go to series, but they shot it, starring Patrick Dempsey, Shelley Duvall, Natasha Gregson Wagner, Seymour Cassell, and Jennifer Garner.
I got to see that pilot. Wow.
I kind of want to see this pilot. I tried to find it online and it doesn't.
Is it like the last thing that Shelley Duvall did, like before she retired?
Yeah. I mean, this was 97, I believe, is when they tried to adapt it. But yeah.
That's peak Natasha Gregson Wagner. It's the same year as Lost Highway, right?
Yep. Yep. Huh. Now Emily's going to try to find this pilot. Doesn't it look good? It looks insane.
Yeah. Patrick Dempsey kind of is good casting for TV Tim Robbins, you know, especially at this point in time.
I think it would work.
So.
Are we sure he was playing Griffin and not the Peter Gallagher character?
He's playing Griffin. I just looked this up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Parks is playing the, the studio exec, the Levison character.
Mm. This has to be one of the first Jennifer Garner roles. It looks like she's playing a teenager. So, yes.
She looks incredibly young.
She's playing, looks like the daughter of the studio exec. It looks like it's a pretty different setup. I got to find this thing.
You got to find it. If you find it, I mean, let us know, because I tried to find it because I was just like, I'm fascinated to see what the hell they. It's also, I mean, I hate, but like, this is not a television show. Like, I don't really know how you make a TV show out of this. It's also such inside baseball. Like, who's going to, anyway.
Well, you know what? Like, do you guys remember this show that was on around that same time with Jay Moore and Ileana Douglas called Action?
Yes, 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 yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, like, probably only one of those shows could exist, and Action only existed for like 6 episodes or whatever.
Yeah. And Action was like, I think it was a Fox show too. So, like, it had this kind of like kooky they're crazy over there, Fox. That's just what they do.
This is like this is that period when like the sort of hidden wisdom is like, you cannot do a show about the industry, no one will watch it, and then like as the TV ratings tank, you can do things like 30 Rock that like people are like, the just enough of a core audience wants to watch that show to like make it successful. But yeah, like I remember in the 90s there would always be like some showbiz satire that critics loved that lasted 8 episodes because nobody watched it.
I mean, that's definitely I am going out to pitch a show in a couple of weeks, and I have been told that you can make a show about Hollywood if you convince them that it's not about Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And so like, like my part of the pitch is 4 sentences long, and it has to be about like, you think of me as a Hollywood person, but this is a story about everything. Or I don't know. Sure. I haven't written it yet, but they're really into the idea. It's mothers and daughters. It's not Hollywood mothers and daughters.
Yes. Yes. No, I think, I mean, like every pitch I've ever made or not made, but like pitched. It's like, what's jazz hands? Like, it's not really It's actually about this.
You're like, yeah, you have to find the thing that is universally applicable to like a situation. About, you know, here's a movie about people who have their brains eaten by worms, and you're like, well, you know what? It's really about marriage. That's a pitch.
About love. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Trauma.
It's about family. Everything's about family. So I want to rate this film, even though I think we're all
what's the player really about? You know, what's the thing that they could say in the pitch? I think this movie is really about just like trying to get ahead at the office.
It's an office drama.
So when I saw this in 92, I loved it. It kind of, you know, changed my brain in terms of how I thought movies were made, or I guess this was basically how I thought movies were made is ultimately what it came down to. I probably would have given it a 90 back then. I'd give it a 92 now. Like I love this movie. I don't real complaints about it outside of June Goodman's daughter, even though she was named after Bjork, which obviously is something I love, but no one else cares about. Emily, what are your thoughts?
I can't believe you find Goodman's daughter hard to pronounce. I just grew up around too many Scandinavians, I think. I like this movie a lot. It's not one of my top five, probably even top 10 Altmans, but like I love Altman so much that that's not really a diss on him. I'm going to give it a 92 for 1992. I would say that back when I first saw it, it was probably closer to like a 96. This movie did make me think like all things were possible.
Karina, what's your rating?
Is 92 your highest now, or do you
99
still
99 is 99.
Okay, so in 1992, I gave it a 99, and now I give it a 999.
That's amazing. I love
perfect.
That.
Perfect. That's the perfect rating. Karina, I'm curious if you have thoughts on the film that we're covering next week, which is Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth. Mm-hmm. Are you a Jim Jarmusch person? Do you like Jim Jarmusch?
I am. And I know that that is not a lot of people's favorite Jarmusch movie, but it is. I mentioned earlier, maybe before we were recording, that I've seen The Player many, many, many times because I bought like a remainder VHS from Blockbuster for $5. And I also did that for Night on Earth. Oh, wow. So I've seen Night on Earth a lot, although when I was a kid, I would skip the Iceland section.
It's a bummer. It's a real, it's a real downer.
Yeah.
It's we have Sean Fennessy from the Ringer podcast. Oh, the Big Picture came on to talk with us about Night on Earth, a film I had never seen before. Emily, I can't remember. Had you seen it? Or
I had not seen it before. And the vibes in that movie are impeccable. Great vibes movie.
It's, you know, it's interesting. I went to see Perfect Days last night, the Wim Wenders film, which I absolutely loved and everyone should go and see, or I guess now stream at home if you choose to. It has very Patterson vibes, very Jim Jarmusch-y kind of vibes to it. And it made me think about, obviously about, you know, that we were recording this and that we're doing Night on Earth, it's just, there's something about Jarmusch tapping into the everydayness of life that I just absolutely adore. Right? I think it's magnificent. Do you have a favorite, chapter from Night on Earth, Karina?
I think I like the LA and New York ones the best, but
sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I that was probably the first Gina Rowlands movie I ever saw. I don't think I had seen it. I don't think I had seen a Cassavetes movie before 1992, 1993. So
sure.
Fun thing about me is that this year, 2024, I have finally internalized that it's pronounced Jarmusch and not Jarmusch, which I've been saying most of my life.
But I mean, you know, just when you think about like the idea that you guys are going from like a Robert Altman movie to a Jim Jarmusch movie, I mean, I sort of get this pain in my heart because like these guys are just so fucking cool, right? Like, and I mean, these are like filmmakers as rock stars to me. And, you know, I'd like to kind of bring that vibe back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now if it's like a filmmaker's rock star, which I think we still have, it's just always kind of like, it's kind of like the same guy, you know, like I love Nolan. I love Fincher, Villeneuve, but like they all are kind of in the same sphere of like, I have mathematically solved how to make a perfect movie and you're going to watch me do it. And like, yeah, there's not the guys making the, like, I guess Soderbergh, but he's off on his own little tangent. So yeah, I missed that.
Soderbergh is the right call. That's probably the right person that's still kind of doing this stuff. But I also feel, we talked about this a little bit on the episode, but you know, Jarmusch is one of those guys who's never really had a blank check per se, but has just kind of found this lane for himself. His movies aren't particularly expensive. Big actors want to work with him. So it all kind of has worked out for him. And he's also a lot older than I think he is. Mm-hmm. It's probably because he has this white hair that he's had since he was 10.
No, he looks the same as he did in 1983.
Yes. Yeah. He's one of those filmmakers, to your point, Karina, that feel so we just don't have many of them right now. To come full circle, I'm going to cling to the hope that you posited at the beginning, Karina, that it's cyclical and that we'll keep getting these types of films made. But more than anything, I'm just so thankful that you came on to talk with us about The Player.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I can't believe you guys are wrapping up 1992.
You know, it's been a year and a half in 1992. I think we've... Emily feels like we've overstayed our welcome.
The deeper we get into it, the more I'm enjoying it. But we did kind of start with a bunch of it was not the best foot forward that 1992.
Part of it is that as this podcast evolves, which it will be evolving into something new at the end of the summer, I think that it's been a very kind of... It doesn't have a format per se. So what happens is we're sort of picking movies somewhat arbitrarily. And in the beginning, I think Emily felt like we were subjecting ourselves to some stuff that we shouldn't be. World broke, Emily, I think.
There are definitely movies from 92 that we're not going to cover that I'm going to be sad we don't cover. But, I'm glad we're hitting the big highlights like The Player and Unforgiven and Beethoven. So
we're gonna wrap this series up with Beethoven.
I don't know if this is something that is right for this podcast, but it would be really interesting to try to talk about a year in film chronologically, in the order that things were released. Just as if somebody does want to hire me to program a full Robert Altman retrospective, I would like to see those movies from the first ones all and end with Prairie Home Companion.
How has the American Cinematheque not hired you to do that? Is the question that I don't. That's what I wonder.
I don't know.
But is there obviously everyone should be listening to your podcast, Karina? Can you tell people where they can hear it and what have you?
It's called You Must Remember This, and you can find it wherever you get podcasts. You can support it on Patreon at patreon.com/Karina Longworth. The 10-year anniversary of the podcast is April 2024, and so we are putting out a line of special edition T-shirts, and we've re-released the first episode of the podcast, which has been quote-unquote lost, basically since August 2014. I remastered it and re-recorded part of it. So it's out on Patreon and for paid Apple subscribers right now, but it's going to be out for free or ad supported the first Tuesday in April.
That's amazing. I mean, your podcast is obviously one of the best. You're one of the best in the biz. Anyone who cares about movies should be listening to it. So I'm just so thankful that you were willing to share your brain with us for a little bit to talk about The Player. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. I was just happy for an excuse to watch it because I hadn't seen it in maybe 3 years, which is a long time for me and The Player.
Sure. Yeah. You guys are close. You try to keep.
I might have a line on this, the pilot. I might have.
Oh, really?
We're going to have to pay money for it.
That's going to be fantastic. Thank you so much, Karina. We'll talk
soon. Of course. Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.